I'm Darius Larson. I'm a campus pastor at St. Cloud State University in St. Cloud, Minnesota. And our forum tonight is entitled, What If We Could Build a Political Platform? I don't know if you would be like myself tonight, sitting at home watching TV as the Republican convention gets on the way, and trying to compare what the Republicans are trying to make statements about as a few months or a month ago when the Democrats had their say on media. But if you do long for the drama of the Republican convention on TV, or if you dream of the day that you could help write a national political platform, this forum is for you. Imagine tonight a new political party has been formed, and we are at its national convention. And what we are going to try to do tonight is to develop maybe not all the planks that we would like to develop on our national platform, but at least some of those planks, in hopes that we could elect people this fall that could believe in some of these planks. And as in all forms, I hope that we will have a variety of opinion tonight, that we will be able to discuss a fairly wide gamut of issues, that there will be some disagreement, and hopefully a good forum is a forum that maybe tomorrow at coffee break you will pull up next to somebody and continue the conversation. We're not here to resolve anything. We're not here to say this is how it should be. Dan Erlander and I have talked about at different times of bumper sticker theology, and the best bumper sticker we could ever come up with is anything that could be reduced to a bumper sticker is suspect. Anything that could be answered in 1 hour at a forum is suspect. It's much more complex than that. But I sure do have lots of fun trying to answer and trying to come up with some sort of conclusions. But we won't finish it all tonight. So, if you could, as we did in one session, I think it was today, it was a Bible study, if you could almost blink your eyes, close your eyes, turn around, or try to image that this here is our convention. We're starting small, but it's a grassroots movement. And what if Holden Village could be a national movement to try to influence people in this coming election? What would it be? What if we could really influence that platform or build our own platform in ways that we could excite the visions of other people? To start us off on that, I've asked two people to list some issues that if they could do this, they might be concerned about trying to get the rest of us to agree with. And I just asked Tom Witt to deal with some of the issues in foreign policy, definitely not all inclusive of foreign policies, and then Jody Kretzmann to take a look at some of the domestic issues, just to kind of set the stage. After they're done, if you want to add some other issues that you would like to talk about, if you'd like to take some issues with them or clarify some of the issues, we want to try to spend maybe the first 15, 20 minutes just kind of what I would call a brainstorming, just trying to see what the vision might be. And then we might just pick a couple of them to see where we can really go with them. So, you put Jody. You want to go first?
Why are you in the back of the room? Be all right. Well, okay, Darius, I'll be happy to kick it off. It's a little ironic because for me the assignment tonight is much closer to what I do in real life than anything in Holden Village. A couple of papers went in fact, to the Democratic National Committee. This spring, before I came out to Holden, about planks in the Democratic platform, so I have to say that that's where, when I do policy work, that's where mine goes, just to make sure that the biases are up front there.
Tell us a bit of what you do in real life.
Work politically from a base in Chicago, Chuck, that allows me to do a lot of stuff, particularly on city policy questions, in an urban studies program and with a variety of issues in the city. So my real love is cities, and the two suggested planks that I sent to the Democratic National Committee had to do with low-income housing and community empowerment strategies and how to work those into a national platform. But let me just say a couple of words about how I, anyway, in my normal life, think about platform building. Partly, you know, thousands of people send in these things to the Democratic National Committee, and it's a bottomless pit, and it just sort of disappears in there, and you never hear about it again, mostly, right? But you do it because you know lots of other people are going to do it too, and you might as well, you know, it's sort of, I think they do what lazy professors do and weigh the number of submissions they've got on low-income housing and throw them down the steps and see which goes further and so forth, and then lead in that direction. Let me just step back from that immediate process for a second and say a couple things. It seems to me that one of the things that political scientists ask about presidential years in particular is whether or not we're facing something that might be called a benchmark election, that somehow captures more than just the every 4 years routine. Mm-hmm. Elections like 1932, when we shifted really quite radically as an entire nation, where major constituencies move from one party to another, when major agendas get redefined in some way or other. The two classic ones, I think, in recent history would be 1932, and probably most political scientists today would say 1968. And the 1968 shifts, in which the Republicans basically broke apart, at least for the next 20 years, the old Democratic New Deal coalition, and built a new coalition built on the South and the Southwest and the West, and that's the coalition that's ruled us for the last 20 years. That's been the last major sort of benchmark election, most political scientists say. So one question asked about 88, when you're thinking about policy, is this possibly one of those benchmark elections, one of those elections that really does, somewhere underneath the surface glitz, have buried in it some major shifts in constituencies or agendas that are on the national mind? That's not an answer that can be, that's not a question that can be answered right away. It's a question that we have to have about 10 years perspective on in order to look back and see. I do think it's possible that in 1988, despite the lack of charisma of either of the major candidates, might be a period of time in the United States which does see that kind of plate tectonic shift in the American people to a different kind of agenda. Domestically, it seems to me we've been through an interesting experimental period where the Republican Party basically for the last 20 years, with only a slight parenthesis of Jimmy Carter's 4 years, has experimented with at least as far in the direction of a free market capitalist economy as you can go in modern industrial society. And they found that there are limits. There are lots of limits. You can't go too far in that direction. You certainly can't go back to Adam Smith. The state and the economy are absolutely and totally intertwined, even under Ronald Reagan. And the government grows, even under Ronald Reagan, domestically. But the emphasis has been on what can the free market do and what can private enterprise do. It seems to me that one of the things that's going on domestically in 1988 is the public is being asked the question, what do they think about that experiment? In my mind, the experiment has had some successes, but those successes have been quite limited, and they've been really in terms of overall GNP growth. And they have not been in terms of a whole laundry list of neglected areas of domestic policy. So I guess that's an introduction to saying that it seems to me that the Democrats this year have the opportunity to shift the attention of the people of the country to a list of unmet needs, which are unmet primarily because they are not the easiest needs to be met by private enterprise. Corporations can't make money off these needs. There's at least no ways have been figured out yet to make these needs money-making. or they are sort of public goods needs that somehow don't fit the portfolio of any particular private enterprise. I have in mind just a quick laundry list of domestic issues that I think have been ignored, are coming to a crisis point because the basic approach of the last 20 years hasn't been able to deal with them. Low-income housing, it seems to me, is increasingly, in cities in particular, a crisis. The number of homeless is not an accident. The number of homeless is the difference between the availability of apartments for low rents and the number of people who need apartments with low rents. And that difference is the homeless, are the homeless. There are some other reasons for that, but basically that's a housing question. And private enterprise has not found a way to make money off low-income housing. Seems to me there's a whole series of job preparation and job training agendas that so far have not been absorbed by the private sector and that probably need to be, and particularly as the economy continues to radically shift from the older industrial economy to a service-oriented economy, some kind of public sector, increased public sector involvement, particularly with the poor, on job preparation and training. And that is directly connected with the third one, which is basic education. Seems to me any of us coming from cities these days understand how desperate the needs of public education are at this point. And not all of the answers have to do with throwing money at public education, but it's still clear that particularly poor neighborhoods in cities and black populations and other populations of color are underfunded and are underserved by an education system that in lots of ways prepares them for failure. Fourth, it seems to me that our deteriorating infrastructure, that is transportation systems, particularly public transportation systems, the bridges in the older cities, everything underneath the ground is now in lots of cities a century old, and that's virtually been ignored, at least by the public sector, over the last 20 years. And finally, well, two more, it seems to me that there's a growing list of unmet needs in the whole energy and environment area, some of which can be met by the private sector, but not all can be. And finally, that the whole major area of healthcare for the poor has surfaced really in both parties as a set of needs that hasn't been met in the last 20 years. Let me just say finally that it seems to me that this list, low-income housing, job preparation and training, basic education, infrastructure renewal, energy and environment, healthcare for the poor, is a laundry list that is not just being recognized by the Democrats. It's significant that George Bush talks more and more about these kinds of needs and related needs. Remember that George Bush's first appearance after the Democratic Convention was before a professional women's association where he unveiled his plan for about a $2.5 billion daycare program that's directly related to job training stuff for women on welfare. And that is a program that simply would not be thought of in the last 8 years as a viable Reagan administration program. And it's one indication of even Bush's recognition that there are some unmet needs left in the wake of the experiment of private enterprise over the last 8 years in particular and 20 years. Overall. So,
Chung. Okay. Tom Witt, who's our director of Lutheran Peace Fellowship and is a world traveler.
Partly. It would be helpful for me if you wrote some of that stuff down. I don't know. On the board.
Why don't you do the laundry list? Right.
I don't really work at all in platforms, so this was an interesting task for me, but I'm just throwing out some suggestions, and mine are much broader than Jody's. And that maybe comes out of a sense that shifts in foreign policy, I see a need for some broad shifts in order to affect some maybe more specific issues that are generally talked about in both parties. But I'm responsible for those first four, and I'll just sort of highlight those or expand on those. The first is redefining what we mean by national security. It seems that for the past 40 years, I think we spent something like $10 trillion on national security purposes as a nation. And yet in 1988, most of us don't feel any more secure. And even more frightening is that we don't really know what national security means. And our tendency has been to define national security primarily in military terms. And what I'm suggesting for our platform is that we challenge that notion and that we challenge the nation to expand our definition of what national security means and to rethink what is it that's in our best interest as a nation. Is it in the best interest of the nation to have military bases all over the world or to have an ever-increasing military budget? Or is it more in our interest to think about national security as encompassing a lot more than military security? Is it in our best interest to have to see ourselves as the world's policemen for freedom? Is it in our best interest to see ourselves as number one? Or is it more in our best interest to see ourselves as a partner along with other powers in the world and to see our security as tied to other countries' security and the security of other nations, including the Soviet Union and the Third World? That's just quickly national security, basically just trying to redefine it and expand that concept, and that shapes our foreign policy. The second, I would ask that our platform really try to end anti-communism as the basis for our foreign policy, which I think it's been for the last 40 years. The chief underlying basis or assumption for our foreign policy is the belief that the Soviet Union is the evil empire, that world communism is threatening freedom all over the world, that we cannot trust the Soviets and the proposals that they bring to us because we cannot trust them to follow through, that the Soviets are bent on world domination, or at least the conquering of Western Europe and eventually the United States. And that more than any single other reason, I think, has been the rationale for our foreign policy for the last 40 years. And I think what we're discovering now is that, first of all, that's a pretty inaccurate picture of Soviet reality, and secondly, it's a fairly naive look at the source of our world problems. And so what I would be suggesting for our platform would be a more realistic and therefore a much more helpful view of the Soviet Union. And by that I don't mean an ignoring of the reality, but maybe a removing of the blinders that have kept us from seeing the reality of what the Soviet Union is about. So that we might see that the most critical problems in our world are not caused by a communist conspiracy, but are more likely caused by poverty and hunger and economic injustice and lack of human rights in both East and West. And I would suggest that not every revolution in the Third World is orchestrated by the communists. So what I'm suggesting, I guess, is an intentional effort to overcome our irrational fear of the Soviet Union. And there's lots of specific ways in which that could happen. Part of that would be building on what I think the Reagan administration has been doing the last year in a way, which is doing more negotiating, doing more cultural exchanges, doing more studying rather than a hostile response, encouraging the openness that is now happening there, and continuation of the talks on arms control and INF treaty and the like, but moving on from there. Another area that relates to that, it's the fourth line, is a commitment to, a real commitment to human rights. And I think a reanalysis of our stance toward the Soviet Union would enable us to take a more consistent and maybe a more credible stance on human rights. I think that our commitment to human rights has been rather weak in the United States. And I think very few other countries take it seriously because I think oftentimes we tend to see human rights violations only in the East and not in the West. And from my travels in the Soviet Union the last couple summers, it's really struck me that dissidents and human rights activists in the Soviet Union don't take the United States seriously on human rights and don't think we have a very strong policy when they see that we support South Africa And when they look at Central America and look at independent human rights groups that will tell you that there's human rights abuses in Nicaragua, but much more abusive situations in El Salvador and Guatemala, countries that we're supporting with billions and billions of dollars. So what I'm asking for, I guess, would be a strengthening of our human rights policy to make it more credible and consistent, and not just support human rights when it suits us best. The same would go with international law, to support international law in the world court, not just when it suits us best as a country, but across the board. And then I would say a more of a holistic peace policy that would say no to nuclear weapons at the same time as saying no to intervention in third world countries. And those, the two of those have to go together, disarmament and non-intervention. And recognize that the policies that were originally created to combat a threat have played a part in producing more of a threat, and that we need to have a reversal of the arms race. I guess that leads to the third one, moving from a war economy to a peace economy, that very specifically, for me, and I would just appreciate response to this, it means very specifically saying that we are caught in a war economy, and that we spend so much of our time and energy and money in the United States now preparing for war that we cannot afford peace, and that we need to begin to reverse that in a very real way by devoting jobs for peace and not for war. So that would, for me, mean an immediate cancellation of SDI, that we don't end an arms race by starting another one, an immediate call for no first use of nuclear weapons, an immediate comprehensive nuclear test ban and a freeze that's been called for by the peace movement, and then consistent cuts every year in military spending, which is now at about 60% of our tax dollar. The preparation for future wars and payment for past wars is about 60% of our tax dollar. And obviously all of those changes would have an impact on the kinds of things that Jody was suggesting for domestic policies, that we begin to reverse the huge disparity between military spending and domestic spending. And then further, to replace militarism, there needs to be lots and lots of work done on developing realistic alternatives to military defense. And that includes the development of strategies for resolving conflicts when they do occur. We're not very good at that. Militarism is our first response, not our last resort. So the development of third-party negotiations and other methods of resolving conflict. And then last resort methods, and there's been a lot of research now done on civilian-based defense and alternative ways of defending one's country, all sorts of those things that institutes for peace would develop and research and bring to the forefront. And I would maintain that that's impossible now, because we're spending so much of our time and energy and resources into militarism that we don't see the other alternatives out there. And the last thing would be economic conversion, that we need to provide industry and jobs for those who are now spending full time preparing for an arms race. I guess I'll just end there and see what we can do.
What I'd like us to do is, if you've been hearing these teasers, as I would like to call them, what excites you and you want to almost say amen to, and you might want to elaborate that a bit, and what kind of gives you a skittish feeling, makes you a little uncomfortable and nervous, and you might want to say, that might be okay, but I'm not quite sure. I just want to know a little bit about that. And then secondly or thirdly, if there's some other planks as you're thinking about them that you'd really like to see up here. And was it you who wrote Nicaragua down?
Yeah.
Do you want to say why you wrote that down, and there's other people who want some other planks up there that we may want to talk about?
Well, the reason I wrote up on Nicaragua is I've been there twice, and I'm very concerned with Tom's talk about human rights abuses in Nicaragua, and especially with U.S. The policy of U.S. imperialism, which is one question I wanted to bring up as far as how far can we go in U.S. imperialism in foreign countries. Basically, I just wanted to discuss the way we treat foreign countries when we feel that they are maybe less than us, they are different than us. Do we have the right to intervene, and if we do, how so, militarily, or do we help them, you know, look on past histories? I wrote it down about U.S. imperialism because that's one example of how it can help and how it can hurt.
Yes.
Yeah, I have two things. One thing on the health care. I disagree that it should be health care for the poor. I think it should be health care, period. I think it has to be a universal program. I mean, it might, different people might pay in differently, but in fact, it's the working poor and a lot of middle class people who don't have health insurance. I mean, the health insurance that the poor have isn't good. I'm not, you know, but I really think if we think of it in that fractured term, it doesn't work, and it has to be a universal system, perhaps like Canada has or something like that. Mm-hmm. And then also in job training, I think it also needs to be job development, mm-hmm. and some sort of plan development. And we have to see if we want to become a service economy and what kind of services we want to develop, because a lot of things are happening in terms of job creation in this country that we have no control over.
Let me just take a quick straw poll. How much of what you've heard so far you might think is somewhat, a portion of it is unrealistic in some way? Just raise your hand.
Okay. In the next 4 years.
Yeah. Okay. How much of it is makes you feel somewhat uncomfortable? Okay. Now, would any of you who raised your hands on either of those questions want to comment on why you raised your hand on either of those things?
Yeah. You mentioned the fact about nuclear warheads and I think maybe you said dismantling them, or, well, I don't know if you said a stop to production or if you wanted to actually dismantle all the nuclear weapons. The problem with doing that is that I believe in stopping the production of nuclear weapons here and now, and not, can, you know, not having any more, because we have enough to blow up the world as much as we want to. Mm-hmm. But the problem is that if we started dismantling all our nuclear weapons and didn't have any left, you have to look at the rest of the world that has the nuclear weapons and says, here's a target, the United States has no weapons left, let's get them. And there are people in the world who obviously would like to get the United States back for some reason or another. So I do believe in stopping them, but I think if we actually want to dismantle our nuclear weapons, we need some sort of agreement between nations who have the most amount of nuclear weapons and doing it on an even level with them. So sooner or later we'll all get down to that, but I don't think if you dismantle them right now, we'd just be left out in the cold.
Other comments? Yeah.
I'd like to add to the list. I think there is a need in our platform for a major commitment to community economic development, not only urban, but I would say even more primarily rural. I think part of the answer to the economic crisis in rural America is in agriculture policy, but a big part of it has to be in providing economic opportunity other than farming in rural America. So I would like to see that added. The second thing I'd add, I guess, is a part of Jody's infrastructure point. Recent experience tells me that this country needs a reliable, dependable national passenger rail system. The people will only use it because it runs on time and does not have surly people serving the people who use it. That's only semi-facetious. I think the point Jody was making about more national investment in public transportation is a very central one. We are way behind most of the Western industrial democracies in that area because we seem to think that if you can't do it through the private market system, it isn't worth doing. And I think it's in the whole interest, the common interest of the whole nation, to have a better, to have better public transportation, urban as well as intercity.
I guess I would want to add, as well, the whole addressing of the international economic order, which is probably the most unrealistic thing that we put up there. But in terms of addressing, the most immediate would be the debt crisis. And then beyond that, looking at the real, the representation that we have on certain international bodies like the International Monetary Fund, and those kinds of systems that I think have an incredible impact on a lot of the things up there. Mm-hmm. I'll go into more detail about that now.
Yes.
I haven't heard anyone say anything about a way to handle the issue of capital punishment. And we need a national policy on that, not a state by state.
What would you like to see?
I'd like to see it abolished.
Just get the Supreme Court to rule punishment.
Yeah.
Right.
And that would wipe it out.
It doesn't solve, it's not the solution to anything as I can see.
I know, you can't really put that in flat.
Except to supposedly assuage the revenge feelings that people mm-hmm. have.
I think the problem is that unless the Supreme Court acts, there's really no way under our system that it can be dealt with federally, because that is given to the states at this point. So you've got 50 state legislatures.
Couldn't you have an amendment to the Constitution? Which
perhaps.
I mean, I don't know what it would say, but it would limit.
That's a possible illegal approach.
Illegal is a death penalty.
But then you still have to get that through 38 state legislatures.
Depending on the Supreme Court, that might be
easier. And then up there, 1 to 2.
I'd like to see us restudy and revamp our whole aid program. I understand 92% of that is military aid, so that we're keeping wars going all over the world. But then the food aid often does not help the countries that it's supposed to help and it's sent to. And I'd like to see us restudy it, revamp it. I don't mean become isolationist. I mean make it so that it helps the other countries instead of others.
Okay, yeah, okay. Up here and then over here.
I didn't hear what Jody had to say about basic education and health care, but I would also like to see some commitment to child care.
Yeah.
He mentioned that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep, that was under job training, I think. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In connection with the foreign aid program, and I suppose also moving from a war economy to a peace economy, I'd suggest applying for free trade would revolutionize the international economy as well as the domestic economy. And the third world countries that are prohibited from developing their own resources because of tariff barriers that are erected.
Okay. Now, for the sake of time, let's not, I mean, how do platforms, I can understand where they get piles and piles of requests, and how long is a typical platform?
Well,
how many players?
I mean, what's interesting is how short the Democratic one is this time.
Yeah.
It doesn't have any of this stuff in it.
Yeah.
And how long it was 4 years ago.
Yeah.
Nobody read it.
Yeah. Yeah.
It could be that the rule is, the longer it is, the more likely you are to lose.
Lose.
Right? Because
right.
Every one of these has opposition.
Yeah. Okay. So what? Rather than adding to it, just for the sake of time, what I would like...
We still have absolutely nothing here on agriculture policy.
That's right.
And I think there is somebody in the group prepared to speak to that.
Okay. All right. Good.
Okay. That's me.
Okay. Go for it.
Since I'm supposed to that part of it, as I'm a farmer, what I'd like to see is to support the present farm program that we have and not try to abolish it, which is the thing that is sort of going to happen now because of our surplus is diminishing, and now they want to throw the farm program out and go back to fence row farming, and that isn't the way to go. We want to continue on with the farm program that we've had and support the Clean Water Act, which has been passed by Congress, and we have to protect our water supply. And I think that's a very critical thing at this point. And also continue on with our conservation restoration program, the CRP, which takes highly erodible land out of production and puts it back into natural grass and so forth. And I would like to see support the family farm and put some type of controls on the corporate farmer that ruins the rural communities by bringing in corporate farms. And I guess something to also remind us that we are only stewards of the land and that the government should support and encourage the conservation practices. And because the land is a very valuable resource and we want to keep that for our future generation.
Good. Now, we have a huge list of things, and we have about 20-25 minutes to develop if we want 1 to 20 of these further. I'm curious to see which ones you may think that we're all in somewhat agreement with and which ones you might think are somewhat more controversial. And so if any of you want to dare venture a guess, we can then, by venturing that guess, other people can challenge your guess to see if your guess is accurate or not. In terms of the people in this place, in this room, whether they agree with the fact of, for example, that we need to move from a war economy to a peace economy. If we're all in agreement there, fine. If we're not, why aren't we? And we may just spend our time on two or three of these, and rather than me decide which one, the will of the person who speaks first to take a straw vote will dictate that.
I really think that's at the base of everything we're talking about. We're talking about 60% of our tax dollars going in that direction. What I want to know is, what's a peace economy in this dangerous world we live in? What is that?
And with that, it's redefining the first one, national security. If we want to redefine that, what is that redefinition? It has something to do with the peacetime economy too. Is that one that tends to have some sort of maybe potential disagreement or need some what do you call it, developing? Yeah. There's a hand over here.
Yep. If we're talking about controversial, and the way it's phrased there, overcoming anti-communism has to be a pretty controversial subject. And that phrase that way, it certainly is.
Do you want to say why you think that is?
Well, I agree. I think the basis of our national security, our national policy over the last 40 or 50 years, or maybe even longer, back to the early days of Bolshevism and so on, has been anti-communism, but to change the way I perceive the basis of the Soviet Union and the way I perceive what I've read of at least early communist doctrine, I wouldn't be in favor of overcoming anti-communism. I think I'm still opposed to it, and I think the majority of Americans are still opposed to it.
In defense of what I heard Tom saying, was overcoming anti-communism for the basis of our foreign policy, but still be, I mean, you didn't use the word suspicious, but
realistic.
Yeah. I don't know if that softens it enough or not. Okay. Couple other thoughts on either?
I was thinking something more of a question or a puzzle. I appreciated a lot Jody's introductory comments about whether or not we're in a watershed, about switching from the privatized basis of the economy to some more public regarding things, because it seemed to me that there was an analysis in there somewhere, and I've been missing analysis a lot lately. But then I was actually quite puzzled, because the things that Tom has proposed seem to me to be one of the few places that in American society today we actually have some strong affirmations about a public good. Now, it's not a definition of a public good that I like very much, when it is defined in terms of a strong Department of Defense and lots of obsolescent weapons and, you know, screws that cost $6 a piece. But there is something, I think, about the way we have defined national security and the war economy that is one of the last vestiges of a total interest in the common good in the United States. And I'm just not sure if that observation of mine is something people might agree with. And if there is something that people who are concerned about peace economies need to think about, if we're, maybe I'm leaping ahead, about making such an agenda legitimate. Because I think that there is a sense in which if you attack or critique the war economy, there's a part of my agenda about public regardingness that feels like it's on shaky ground. There. Is that, could that just fly out the window?
No, I think so. I think that there's a link, which is actually what was said earlier about the that really the issue was, after you define a peacetime economy, transferring it in. And I think the way you do it in terms of the national good is, and I'm plagiarizing this admiral I heard speak at this conference, is to say that our national defense is to have strong education, to have a strong infrastructure, to have a healthy functioning economy. And then that becomes a very strong national defense. If you don't have that, if you don't have that in place, and then it's sort of rotten within, you know, and you really you don't have confidence in conducting war, is what he was saying on one hand, but also then what are you defending? And I think it's almost to make our domestic policy our defense policy would be a way of cutting it.
Interesting. Yeah.
I have a different point, sort of that that involves a whole bunch of points that we brought up, and it's the issue of whether or not our government should be turning more to a more capitalist, though it is a very capitalist society, turning more capitalist or more socialist, because a lot of things we have here deal with free trade, individual rights, corporations. Does the government have a say in what the individual does? And I'm just curious about what people think about the extent that the government can have over, perhaps if you're in a corner store, what can they say about it? Because, I mean, for me, socialism, not pure socialism, but getting that way when you've got a nation of people working together for the good of the nation is better for, I mean, I understand that if you use a lot of socialism in your government, every now and then you're denying individual rights because maybe someone can't own their corner store, they can't own their own farm because you need to have a lot of government involvement with that. But I'm interested in what people think about how much involvement can the government have in our personal lives, how much control, and is it good or bad?
Anybody want to comment on any of these last three points, which I think are all wonderful? Private good to public good, which is another way of maybe saying that without the baggage of the word socialism, which sometimes has different connotations to different people. It also brings in maybe the overcoming the anti-communism flavor and also moving to the peacetime economy of a strong national defense or national security is really about domestic policy, health, education, and welfare things, if that's where the focus should be, if that's where national security is. I mean, does this excite you? Is this something that would get you, you know, leafletting and trying to work for candidates to actually say, this is what I believe, or are you saying, wait a minute, this is too much pie in the sky, or it won't sell, or, you know, what motivates you to be involved in a plank or a platform or a party, you know, in that sense. Yeah.
I don't think there's very many people in the room that would argue with anything that has been said here in terms of objectives. But a society and people need a tangible mechanism to achieve it. So if you could carry the discussion somewhat further and move it, okay, how would you do something? Move it from
where you are today to where you would like to be tomorrow, with points that would be, or you believe would be understandable and viable by the public today. That would be very helpful to me to understand some of these things that we're talking about.
Chuck's going to try.
Well, I'm going to respond to it by saying if we were to do that, in fact, it wouldn't be a platform. It wouldn't be a typical platform. Platforms typically are not taken seriously at all. They don't do that. And they never talk about the revenue to carry it off. No. The only candidate this year who really talked about seriously about increasing revenue was Bruce Babbitt. He didn't go anywhere. And Fritz Mondale tried to suggest it 4 years ago, and it helped him contribute to his defeat. I think that if we're really talking about a platform in the traditional sense, then we just go with our list of wishes and let it go at that. Wow. But then nobody takes it very seriously either.
Well, it's back to the point of the platforms that were developed, long or short. So what? I'm saying if you're going to try and develop a meaningful platform,
I agree with you, but
then what's a meeting?
But that's not what parties are doing.
I'm saying this party should.
This whole Democratic Party will be a different party. Now, how different? Do you want to give an example? Or somebody wants to...
majority, right? This is.
Yeah. Yeah.
If we're going to start a new party, then I think we have a chance here to do something really different in terms of maybe moving away from the traditional platform. I think that... a lot of the problem with American politics, and probably politics in general, is that it seems to run on the energy of different groups with different interests and different agendas competing with one another for influence. The group that can get the most power behind it at any given time tends to get its agenda put into policy. But all this is done without any, as I see it, any cohesiveness in our society at all. And certainly no solidarity and really no sense of what our goals are as a nation. So my idea to be really different would be to back off from the issues a little bit. At best, maybe all of us in this room who are forming this party could come to agreement on a platform of issues. But then what's going to happen when we go out into the real world with our platform? My guess is for quite some time it's going to be rejected. And working on it may make us feel good. And I think it will do the world some good. But what I think the best we could hope for is that sometime maybe in 8 years or 12 years or 16 years, we would get just enough of a majority of support for some of our plans to be turned into policy. But then the pendulum could swing the other way in another 10 years, and I don't know if we'd really be making any permanent constructive changes. But if for now, forming a new party, we could back off from the issues a little bit and have the courage to just say, okay, what we want to do is knit this country together, form some goals, get people together at the grassroots, build our communities, get people in touch with one another, get them paying attention to what's going on, and get them participating in democracy like they should be doing. And let all of the ideas for what we should be doing come right up from the grassroots, rather than going out to people with the planks and the platform. We feel this way about this, we're for this, we're against that. Just start right from a position of openness and see what the people think and develop a real long-term strategy for change that way.
Another way we could go, you know, to try to, as hard as it is, to envision a party that's different from the parties that we're used to and the difference of planks and platforms and go at it, you know, a different way. After all, something's afoot in the universe. You know, that could be our motto for our...
Just one quick response to that. I resonate a lot to that. Another way to say what you're saying, it seems to me at least part of what you're saying, is to say that electropolitics is only a part of the ballgame, that we need to think about ourselves as public people in lots of ways that don't involve elections or platforms, that build communities, in fact, that revision what families in community and what learning and what work means to people and all of those sort of basic questions that you can never get into a political party platform. So I like a lot about what you're saying. For me, it moves me at this point, realistically, away from electropolitics for some of that most important work, because you can't fit it into the way the electoral game gets played.
Yeah. Let me screw things up by throwing some theology in here. It seems to me that platforms are designed to win and gain power. So I get almost uncomfortable thinking about trying to find ways where we as a party might gain power and have that as our objective. It seems to me that whole business about he was the great king of God would be servant of all, and all that whole theology ought to impact everything that we think about. The other reason I'm thinking about this, I just came back from a conference on BART, in which one of the Bartian theologians there said that Karl Barth's assessment of Lutheran theology was that Martin Luther was directly responsible for the rise of Adolf Hitler in Nazi Germany, simply because Lutherans always seem to divide this business of power and gospel in the theology of the two kingdoms. Mm-hmm. And for us to sit here and say, well, we're going to develop anything, even if it's grassroots, and gain power is always utilitarian and somehow runs against, it seems to me, the grain of the gospel. I'm more in tune with what Ron Sein talks about in The Mustard Seed Conspiracy, that little book in which he says the kingdom of God grows in little secret ways and not in platforms and political agendas and all that sort of thing. The danger in that is that you can become apolitical and just sort of throw up your hands and don't do anything.
Maybe let me just try something here for a way of concluding. I mean, we're not going to conclude right now, we got about 5 minutes, but the question is, how and in what way should we, as those of us who are here as Christians, be involved, whether it be in this political party or in another political party, as we deal with issues like this? Should we be what I heard you saying was not we don't want our platform to wreak shooterisms, you know, in theological terms, if you want to call it that. What should we be about? Who should we be about? And is power important? Can we affect people? Can we affect the political process? And is that our duty and our task? And should this platform, I didn't mention, no one else mentioned, and I kind of like that we're not even supporting necessarily any candidates. Usually, if I understand a platform, whoever is the candidate is the one who has the power to say what's in and out of the platform. And this is, we haven't even mentioned a candidate, so it leaves the opportunity for us to develop a platform and then later see what candidates out there in other parties may support it or not, and then work for those particular candidates. I said about three things there versus one. We all feel, do we not, that Christians, believers in something other than what is right here, and believers in that which is here, should be involved in a political process. Can we say that?
Yes.
I mean, would anybody take issue with that statement? That we should be political people. in what way and how active we should be may be a difference of opinion. How many of you do think that we do have as our vocation or advocation should be about dealing with these issues or other issues in the quote secular world? Is that a way that we should be, should we be active in that? Or is that an issue? The issue I heard you raising then, which is the next step further if I'm following this right, is that we should not be active in it to the extent that what we seek is the power, but that these platforms and our planks should point us beyond our own selves, beyond our own party. And isn't that what both Democrats and Republicans say they're all about? Or are they saying we're about a private good versus a public good?
What they do is that.
Yeah, what they do is another question too.
I may have misunderstood, but I really heard you raising questions not so much just about whether or not power became an end in itself. I heard you raising questions about even using power. Whether or not to even use power as a way of pursuing certain goals, even if they are quote theologically correct, is valid within a Christian framework. Is that fair to
say? That's part of it. The other part of it is too easily dividing secular power from spiritual power in the two kingdoms.
Okay.
And sort of washing our hands and saying that's dirty. So we can't do that either.
See, I sort of see those almost in conflict with each other.
You got it. So do I.
Okay. All right. I was just trying to clarify because I didn't think exactly that was exactly.
Maybe one or two more, and then I'm going to ask if Jody or Tom may want to say something about what they've sensed and felt based on what they presented here, if they want to do some sort of summary feelings about where they're at. You had a question? No? Okay. Oh, we'll let Tom go first this time.
Jody gets the last word. Maybe I just throw another something into the ring, which would be some of the people that I'm associated with are almost on another level, and again to throw in a little theology, in the midst of working through this political process and supporting platforms and doing everything that a good U.S. citizen ought to do to further important national values that are worthy to support, I'm associated with some folks who are struggling with whether or not it is indeed a special time in history that we are again in a confessional situation, that perhaps it's time, perhaps there isn't room any longer for differences of opinion in the Christian community, as we've all said there are for all these issues, but perhaps we are in a confessional moment that says, to be Christian, one must support blah, blah, blah. And for different people, it's different issues. For the Lutheran World Federation, that has meant to be a Christian, to be a Lutheran, means to be opposed to apartheid in very real ways. As far as I'm concerned, to be a Christian means the renunciation of the threat to use nuclear weapons and the production of those weapons. There are others that are talking about a confessional movement against the U.S. war against the poor, and an international economy that wages that war as well. So those are all sorts of other issues, but it brings us to another level of, does there come a time for Christians that perhaps all this matter of choice becomes really a matter of confession after a time? It's a terrible thing to throw out at the end of a forum, but
that's over coffee break.
But it's wonderful. That's what I'm struggling with.
Yes. Yeah.